almost too much happening in isolation. And that's where I think it becomes crucial to basically bring all these different efforts together mm-hmm. and create mass platforms okay. to replace the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. The value of mainstream media, yes, there's no point in trying to break those walls at the New York Times. We're never going to get ethnic cleansing in there, as we can have as many, you know, unofficial sources saying this or that. Like, ethnic cleansing will never appear. Palestinian voices will never have the same level sure. of authority or space in those papers. Or those kinds of spaces. So I think it's really about these alternative mass platforms that we can build, and this is where I think joint initiatives are really important. So it'd be great to see CKUT in the Daily, because CKUT has had a history of having Palestinian programming, has connections and all sorts of relationships in the community beyond campus. The broadcast that we did for the 60th anniversary of the Nakba was a great opportunity to go and speak with people who are alive at that time and told their own personal narratives. All of that could have been transcribed and made available in the Daily, or represented in multimedia form on your website to share with your community of readers. But we need to build bigger communities through our media, bigger audiences that are listening to us, and we don't have to do that in isolation. It's not about the Daily getting bigger or CKT getting bigger. It's about us uniting our resources and acting together and basically using our collective power and spaces and volunteers to further amplify the cause. And so I'd like to see definitely more of that as we go forward, not just creating more alternative media opportunities, but creating mass platforms, but also ensuring that those mass platforms are rooted directly to people creating and generating media in Palestine.
That was a portion of a recent speech given by Stephen Saleta, along with Gretchen King of CKUT Radio and Emmett Livingstone of McGill University. Thank you so much to Gretchen King and McGill University for the use of this audio. For more, visit electronicintifada.net. And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. You can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and on behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
KBOO and the Clinton Street Theater are proud to present a music documentary that raises the bar for the genre. Arrows into Infinity, the new documentary about the life of jazz musician Charles Lloyd. Thursday, April 9 at the Clinton Street Theater. Arrows into Infinity takes us on Lloyd's journey from the heights of jazz rock royalty to his life in seclusion and back again. Arrows into Infinity, the Portland premiere. Thursday, April 9, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. 2522 Southeast Clinton, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7. The time is 11:02. Coming up at 11:30 on Art Focus, we'll hear about the Black Arts Movement, started by Amiri Baraka. The Black Arts Movement was once described by Time magazine as the single most controversial moment in the history of African-American literature, possibly American literature as a whole. Up next, it's Stage and Studio with host Dimae Roberts. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
I'm Dimae Roberts, Stage and Studio, and I'm at Shaking the Tree Theater's new space in Portland, and I'm standing here in this humongous space with artistic director and founder Samantha Vandemerva. Hello, Samantha.
Hi, Dimae.
So take me on a tour. Take us all on a tour of Shaking the Tree's new home.
All right, let's go.
What am I looking at just right here?
Well, you're in the lobby area. We've created a little area to sign in. And then you will step through the curtains onto the stage and into the theater.
So how big is this space?
This space is 2,800 square feet.
If you were to say how many times bigger than your previous space on Stark Street?
I think it's 3 times bigger.
At least.
Yeah.
And taller, too. So yeah. You have to include the loft area
because
the ceilings are way up there. It's like 2 stories or 3 maybe, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so take us on a tour. Let's go
for it. So here we are. Come on in. As an audience member, you'll sit on this end. You want to sit down?
Sure.
And look up at our stage. I knew that for this play, I wanted to have a very long stage. I wanted some depth.
And so how many feet do you think that is? I mean, you've got this set that looks amazing here. Describe it for us.
I think it's about, well, it's 50 feet from one end to the other. We've got our patio area in front where most of the action takes place.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a garden in New Orleans, right?
Yeah.
Or New Orleans.
Yes, exactly. So it's a garden. The garden is kind of behind us, but we've also imagined that the garden is really all around us and that this is a resting area, this place in the middle.
And describe that top. There's this kind of hill area with a lot of paper flowers.
Yes. So, you know, in the play, Tennessee Williams describes it as this very old, this pre-Edenic garden and of these giant plants. And that, for me, is his, well, there's such a metaphor in the play, but it's also his place of magic. You know, he has us in realism, but every now and then he transports us to this other place, and that's, for me, what the garden represents.
So there's a little bit of fantasy element, which is kind of, I don't want to say your trademark,
thing.
But yeah. It kind of is, isn't it?
I do. I love it, and that's why he's such a good playwright for me, because, well, he's teaching me about realism, for sure, about just being in this very real moment, but he has these places in the play where he, through his writing, he just takes you to this place that he has created.
Well, he's a very poetic writer, and there's so much imagery to everything. I mean, if you look at all the plays, Streetcar Named Desire, there's always this reference to the past, and that past always seems to be such a beautiful place, beautiful place than the present.
Yes, everything seems to be vivid and clear, like a dream.
And a fable, even.
Yes. And he's talking to us in metaphor, and there's so much symbolism going on. And we called them these time expansion moments, where time just seems to stand still for the characters. And yes, he paints this beautiful imagery. So how do you create that for your audience? How do you take them on that journey each time one of those moments opens up?
And that's what you've done with this, it looks like. So let's walk a little bit around the set and then maybe other parts of the space. Because this is really, as far as a playing area, I have to say, this is at least 3 times bigger than what you've had. Well, not twice as big, at least. Because you've made your area work in the past. But, this must feel like a luxury to you.
Well, it's a little overwhelming at first. But then you realize, especially for this play, that we need it. We want the garden to be separate. We want it to be a place that no one really goes to, except...
Can people actually climb up here?
Yeah, do you want to try?
No,
it's very steep.
It's very steep, but you must be able to get on the other side.
What's
nice is this is on radio, so you're not spoiling it for everybody, right?
Yeah.
Because, you have everybody's creating these mental pictures for themselves before they see the show. So so here we go. We're walking the set. And how many are you seating here in this house now?
I'm seating 48 this time.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. You could probably seat more.
We could, but I'm stubborn that way. Like, I want everyone to have a good view, and I want the audience to be on this one end. It was just a very clear vision in my head when I stood in the space and thought, how am I going to stage this? So then, luckily I don't have anyone wagging their finger at me telling me that I should be selling more seats.
Well, you know what, though? I think that you're going to have to. I mean, just knowing your work,
I am.
48, you're going to fill that
we'll
up.
Grow. So we'll grow into it.
Sure. Okay, so here's the backstage area. Yeah. You've got a little bit of playing area here.
Yeah. We have, there's a window that a few key characters stare out of at various points in the play. And with Jeff Wood's wonderful lighting, he just illuminates this area for us. And this, to me, the curtain part here just feels like a window.
It did look like that. It's very gauzy. Yeah. And so Jeff is doing the lighting. Who else, who did the set?
I did the set. With the help of Ted Gold, who's the technical director and also was a collaborator on the set.
Now, do you have options for multimedia in this place, too?
Yes, and we've hidden our projector down there.
Don't spoil it for anybody. No. Okay. I'm not going to say where it is. But so you, yeah, because you do a lot of nice effects with sound and imagery a lot of times. So that's great that you're keeping that tradition.
It helps to tell the story. The projections seem to help enhance it this time.
So what do we have here? You actually have a shop?
Well, here is our office/storage/dressing area.
All right.
This is where the men...
Because you didn't have much of that before.
We had a back room, but it was a little rougher than this. Not that this isn't rough, but, you know.
But there's a little bit more room, so you can actually store things back here.
And here are the ladies.
Ah, the dressing area for the ladies. Nice.
But also I have all my, you know...
Your costumes?
My materials.
Yeah. From past shows, because it's like mask, that's one fleece bear, and what's this, Wild Tales, so far away. You've got all the marked things you might save for the future.
Yeah, I like to keep a box of everything from the show, and then it just kind of, when I open it up, all the memories come.
This is so exciting for you, Samantha. I mean, for one thing, I guess I didn't follow the story why you needed to leave.
Oh, okay. Well, the property owner passed away. And he...
That was on the Stark Street
space. That was on the Stark Street space. And he was part of a trust, and he kind of managed the trust. And we knew it would take some time for the family to decide whether they were going to sell or not. But then when I knew they were going to sell, I started to look. And it took a while. It took 6 months to find.
And so when you got the news, I mean, it wasn't like a sudden thing.
No, it wasn't a sudden thing, but when you know that you have to move, it's a stressful thing, especially since I need my classes to continue and we had shows planned.
Yeah, you teach youth classes.
Yeah, I teach drama. So we needed a new home, and I just wanted, it was something that I needed to be on top of.
So how challenging was that move for you?
Well, we were going to sign the lease here in September, and then things were delayed. So during our rehearsals for Mask of the Red Death, we had a cutoff date of when we would decide to stay in the old space or move. And when it seemed like they weren't going to be ready for us, we had to make the decision to do the play at the old space. So that was a little stressful because I had imagined it in a much larger space. So we squeezed it in there, and then we moved in December.
I did follow along that you were getting donations for lights and things like that. So what was the, I guess, the community support in your move?
Oh, it's been phenomenal. We put out a call to have people help us move. And that morning, just a wonderful group of people showed up. And then we needed to eventually put in the floor, and people showed up for that, and people contributed to purchasing the wood for the floor. And then we also want to put lights around the outside to keep things safe and hospitable for our patrons, and people donated to our lighting campaign. So the support feels really wonderful.
And how long of a process was it for you for the move itself?
Well, I'd say for Mask, I already had moved stuff out of the back room because we knew we needed to use it for the show. So that was the first part of the move for me. And then the minute the show closed, it was just really about packing and strategizing.
So within a month then?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's still fast when you have so much history at your prior space. I mean, I dread even having to move if I ever have to move from a house I've been in for 20 years, right?
Yeah.
So is this a permanent space?
I hope so. I love this area. I love
the, it's kind of industrial, but kind of I hate to say it, but clean industrial. You know, it isn't like smoky.
It's light use industrial, and you know, we never know with Portland booming as it is if the whole division kind of restaurant scene will move its way down here. That would be a wonderful thing as far as, you know, visibility and safety and all that is concerned. But I'm worried about being priced out if the neighborhood becomes hot. But that's the problem with arts groups, right? We start settling these neighborhoods and then the properties become too expensive for us to rent.
Ah, so you're the first stage of gentrification, huh?
Maybe.
Not the Starbucks.
But hopefully, you know, I chatted with my landlord and I said, you know, they have an opportunity to be advocates for the arts, and we should have we should have art spaces in all neighborhoods. We can't just be a city that has, you know, really good restaurants and breweries. We need art dispersed throughout the community. So,
well, maybe you should talk with a bunch of people like Conduit and buy this building.
Huh? Yeah.
There's a concept. And then have it be a multi-use space.
Yeah, that would definitely be an option. And we'll talk about all of those options we got to learn if we love the neighborhood first.
Because this is your inaugural production.
Yeah.
All right. So I'm Dee Mae Roberts, stage and studio with artistic director Samantha Vanda Merva. We're on location at her new space for Shaking the Tree Theater. That's located at 823 Southeast Grant Street in Portland. And we're about to talk more about Shaking the Tree's production of Suddenly Last Summer by Tennessee Williams. And that show runs through May 2nd, Thursdays through Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 5 p.m. For more info, you can reserve tickets online also at their website at shaking-the-tree.com. So it's shaking-the-tree.com. And you can also call their box office at 503-235-0635. You can get all that info as well as this podcast of the show on stageandstudio.org. Now, I want to talk about Tennessee Williams with you.
Yes.
Because we started talking a little bit about him as you were taking a tour of the set, or giving me a tour of the set.
Yeah.
It's set in New Orleans, Nollins, and Garden, that once belonged to Sebastian, who was a poet who died tragically.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple other characters, like this young woman, Catherine, who was with Sebastian,
mm-hmm.
and she's being grilled, almost interrogated by his mother about his death. What was it that drew you to this play?
It really was. I remember reading this play when I was in high school, and I think I was probably looking for monologues, and the imagery of the street that they were on and the pictures that he paints in this brutality of what he's trying to tell us about in the story as it's slowly revealed were just really striking to me. So I've always loved it for the poetry and for the imagery. The play is set in 1936. It was written in the 50s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, but it was actually, what I was reading then, to clarify, was that because it was written in the 50s, it kind of, even though it refers back to the 30s, it really was about some of the issues, especially about homosexuality at the time and the repressive society. And this is something that, I don't know if Williams wrote much more, another play that dealt with it as much as this one.
Well, it comes out in a lot of his plays, but to me this feels so autobiographical, because he's not only looking and dealing with his demons and how to exist in a world that doesn't approve of who you are as a human being, but he's also looking at the history of what happened to his sister, who was given a lobotomy.
He writes a lot about his sister, a streetcar named Desire, and
Glass Menagerie.
Glass Menagerie. I mean, that she was so tragic and she had mental health breakdowns, but it wasn't because she was... It was all like external forces causing it.
Well, I read something really interesting, that if she had been diagnosed in our time, she would have been diagnosed with Asperger's, which is, you know, something that we've learned about, that we accept.
It's a form of autism.
Yeah. Right. So can you imagine, and this was a huge revelation to all of us as we were doing our table work, you know, to be off the norm and with doctors not knowing what to do with you, and then to have these
experimental treatments at the time, like lobotomies, which actually was used a lot for women who were sexual too.
Exactly.
And so that's another issue in this play, because the sexuality of Catherine, but also, I mean, I'm thinking of a streetcar, and you know, there's always that tendency to lock them up and give them a lobotomy.
Yes.
I mean, as a solution.
Which is what Tennessee Williams' mother wanted to happen to Catherine, because she couldn't cope with these outbursts.
Or the mother in Suddenly Last Summer.
And the mother, yes.
Yeah.
So Violet Venable, who is the mother, Sebastian's mother in Suddenly Last Summer, feels very closely drawn from Tennessee Williams' own mother, which is a little frightening.
It is very frightening. and it feels autobiographical, and I think, you know, obviously, you know, you've read about it, I mean, and researched it. But one thing I was reading about is also about his idol, Hart Crane, the poet, that some of the death mirrors that poet. He was an up-and-coming poet in the 20s, and he killed himself mainly because he was a closeted homosexual, and he jumped off of a cruise ship. And so that tragedy, too, you know, kind of mirrors Sebastian's mysterious death.
Yes. It's a very ritualistic death. It's based on a Dionysian myth, you know.
And tell us about that myth, because it's so brutal.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Let's see if I can...
For PG terms. I mean, basically, we want to give away too much of that? But just about the myth itself.
Yeah, well, really, it's about a king who challenges the god and says that he's just as important as the god Dionysus or Bacchus in Roman times. And the god gets his followers to find him to lure him out into the forest and basically cut him up and sacrifice him, offer him as a sacrifice.
And that's just used as an analogy for some of the things that happen in the play. So this play is not recommended for anybody younger than 14.
I think probably it wouldn't be that interesting to them, or a little heavy.
Yeah, I would think so too. But it does seem like the issues are very timely too.
I think they are. You know, we think we're progressing, but we live in a world of so many taboos, and whatever we decide is evil or wrong, we demonize. And then what do you do if you are a person who is being demonized by a society? How do you come to terms with yourself as a whole person?
Yeah, and there's so much going on right now. I'm thinking in terms of Indiana and the banning. I mean, the legal banning of gays is just amazing to me that exists now. It's almost like this knee-jerk reaction. But in some ways, I mean, that is still there. It's probably repressed as much as homosexuality was repressed back in the 30s, obviously, and the 40s and the 50s. Actually, up until... Recently,
you know, you had to live a secret life. And Violet Venable's insistence that her son was chaste, he was celibate, she was
pure,
his other.
I think she uses words
pure,
like that, right?
Is just this need to cut off and reject this whole part of a person that is so close to you, which I think is very true to William's life.
Well, you've got some great actors in this. You got Jackie Maddox as Violet.
Yes.
Who else is in the show? Louisa Sermol, who I talked with recently, is in it.
Is Mrs. Holly. And Beth Thompson is Catherine Holly, Sebastian's cousin, who has to tell the story of what happened. Matthew Kerrigan is the doctor. Dr. Sugar is his name. Steve Van Der Zee is George, Catherine's brother. And then we have Rebecca Ridenour as Miss Foxhill, who's Mrs. Venable's assistant, and which is quite a comical part. She does a lovely job with that. And Dana Milliken as the nun who brings Catherine to Mrs. Venable's house.
Very strong cast. And when you were talking about Matthew Kerrigan being the doctor, I was thinking in the film version, wasn't that Montgomery Clift?
Yes.
Which was ironic because he was closeted at the time.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that adds all these weird layers to the history of this play.
Yeah.
So is Shaking the Tree doing something different now with having an actual ensemble? Because I saw that on your website.
Yes, we have a performance group. I think there's six of them now.
Or a formal ensemble.
Yes, yeah. And right now we're still talking about what that means. They help teach a class once a week to our intermediate students, which we've all been loving. And the idea is to work together over time to develop a vocabulary, especially when it comes to generating new work. It's very exciting to me to have people who I can work with over time, because I think we just developed this lovely language that we can all speak. And they're just lovely people to work with, so I want them around.
And it's shortcut, you know, you just go right to the work, right? Cut out everything else. Well, in the time remaining, you've got a couple of Tennessee Williams one-act readings, too. One's on April 15th at 7:30 p.m. and another on April 29th at 7:30 p.m.
Yes.
That seems a little bit added, because I don't remember you doing readings.
I haven't, and it came out of us. I remember the day we sat. We were having a performance group meeting, and we sat under the trees because it was so beautiful. And we said, what if we... because I had his book 27 Wagons Full of Cotton, and there is one of the short plays in there is my all-time favorite, again, that I found when I was in high school. Oh my gosh, I'm going to blank on the name right now. It's beautiful. Yeah. And we read through that, and we read through a whole bunch of them and thought, wouldn't it be fun, just since we love his, we're enjoying his writing so much, why don't we share a few of those shorter ones? And then we put it on the calendar, and
there you go.
There you
and
go.
You have a whole repertoire right there for your season. So in the last words about your hopes, big dreams for this space. This is your inaugural production suddenly last summer, you know. And I always start humming the Motel song in my head when I say that title. That's just me, though. So any big dreams, because the world is your oyster right now, right?
Well, I mean, I want to make it a workable, sustainable space where not only we can do productions, but other companies who are looking for space can do productions. And I also, I love this idea of things morphing and growing, and just knowing that it started out as a very rough warehouse and seeing how it will grow and change with each play is exciting to me. I know that we have lots of problems to solve, and it's really, that's life, right? You have
it's
to go
life.
One step at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And solving those problems is actually part of doing the work.
It's part of the evolution, isn't it? And the progress and the change. Samantha Vandermeerve, thank you so much for the tour today and the talk.
It's a pleasure.
And looking forward to seeing Suddenly Last Summer and your inaugural production in your new space. Suddenly Last Summer by Tennessee Williams runs through May 2nd, Thursday through Saturdays at 7:30 p.m., Sundays at 5 p.m. The show's recommended for ages 14 and up. More info at shaking-the-tree.com. We have
and
a railroad.
There's
a train coming through.
That's
perfect for it. And so you can also call them at 503-235-0635. And you can check out the new space at 823 Southeast Grant Street in Portland. And you can find all that info, as well as the podcast of this interview and the sound of this railroad train running through at stationstudio.org. That's it for Stage and Studio. Samantha, thanks so much for everything today.
Thanks, Dime. It's always a pleasure.
You can hear this show again at stageandstudio.org or podcast on iTunes, or tweet me at Stage the Letter N Studio, or go to facebook.com/StageTheLetterNStudio to keep up on all the events. Till next time, I'm Dime Roberts.
It keeps me standing still. It takes
Stay tuned at 11:30 for Art Focus. We'll hear about the Black Arts Movement.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Susan Griffin, Sustainability in the Soul, Thursday, April 9th, 7 p.m. in the Sanctuary. Susan Griffin is an internationally celebrated writer who will speak on the false divisions our culture makes between body and soul, masculine and feminine, self and other, that allow us to hide from our own knowledge. Again, that's Susan Griffin, Sustainability and the Soul, Thursday, April 9th, 7 p.m. in the Sanctuary, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The Black Arts Movement was once described by Time magazine as the single most controversial moment in the history of African American literature, and possibly in American literature as a whole. It was started in Harlem by writer and activist Amiri Baraka. The movement was triggered by the assassination of Malcolm X, and among the well-known writers who were involved with the movement were Nikki Giovanni, Sonia Sanchez, Maya Angelou, Hoyt Fuller, and Rosa Guy. The movement is also seen as the most important times in African-American literature. It inspired Black people to establish their own publishing houses, magazines, journals, and art institutions. Before the movement, the literary scene lacked diversity, to say the least, and the ability to express those ideas from the point of view of people of color. The Black Arts Movement changed that. It influenced the whole world of literature with the portrayal of different ethnic voices. Theater groups, poetry performances, music, and